So really trying to think about the student as a whole person, and where does this class, where does this course fit into their lives? And then how can I make it so that they're as successful as possible, reaching their potential, and also happy, like Nina said. I don't think that these are impossible things to do.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. The mental health of college students is now a hot topic. The Center for Collegiate Mental Health found in a 2015 report that between 2009 and 2015, the number of students visiting counseling centers increased by about 30% on average, even though enrollment grew by less than 6%. But most counseling centers are working with limited resources. The average university has one professional counselor for every 1,737 students, fewer than the minimum of one therapist for every 1,000 to 1,500 students recommended by the International Association of Counseling Services. But is there anything that can be done in the classroom itself to support student mental health? In 2017, the Hogg Foundation launched a grant initiative aimed at improving academic achievement through mental health. We funded 7 projects with the goal of bringing mental wellness into educational settings. One of the most innovative of these is right here at the University of Texas through the Counseling and Mental Health Center. The Well-Being and Learning Environments project is geared toward undergraduate students. It works with faculty in the design and delivery of their courses to better support student mental health. Thea Woodruff is the project coordinator of the Well-Being and Learning Environments Project. Joining her is Nina Talang, who teaches at the College of Engineering. Thea and Nina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so what is the thinking behind Well-Being and Learning Environments, and what does it hope to accomplish?
Yeah, so the idea behind the project is that student mental health is just as important as their cognitive development and their learning of the content. The idea is that faculty can do small things. It doesn't have to be huge things in the classroom that can support student mental health, student well-being. That's why we like to use the term well-being and sort of thinking about students more as the whole student versus just the developing of the content and the learning of and the cognitive aspect. So the idea is to help faculty kind of think about what are small things that they can do in their class that can make a big difference for students. And when you talk to students, when I've been doing focus groups or interviews with students, the things that students talk about that faculty who are doing these things already, what they do in their classroom, they're not talking about mind-blowing, crazy types of things that are that just take so much effort on the part of faculty. They talk about things like getting to know them as human beings, humanizing themselves so that they talk about their failures and the struggles that they've had to overcome and then how they've come out better in relation to those struggles and sharing those struggles. Talking about things like just showing up to class early and playing music and talking with students about their lives, about how things are going, carrying on informal discussions about, you know, what are their goals in life, what they want to do. So not just focusing on content, but focusing on themselves as human beings and sort of their entire lives. So these aren't really things. There are other things that are bigger things that we know can sort of support student well-being, but the things that a lot of faculty are doing, a lot of people who are working on this project, are very simple things that really anybody could do if they just sort of change their mindset maybe a bit about how they think about instruction in the classroom.
Okay, and for the listener, that was Thea Woodruff, the project coordinator. Nina, if you'd like to add anything to that, feel free.
Yeah, well,
I believe that happy students are productive students. And by productive, I mean not just students who get the highest grades, but students who just feel accomplished and feel like they're reaching their potential. And they're more likely to do that if they are happy and they have a good kind of sense of themselves and they feel like they are noticed and rewarded and they feel like they're reaching their potential. So whatever we instructors can do to help that, I think is important.
Okay. So what evidence is there? I'm sure there's a lot of evidence. I alluded to a little bit of it in my intro, that something like this is really needed.
Yeah. So to talk, you talked about the percentage of students, the increasing numbers of students. The same is true at the University of Texas Counseling and Mental Health Center. So since I believe the 2009-10 school year through to 2016-17, the increase is 62% of students, the number of students accessing the mental health center. So that mm-hmm. number has gone up by 62%. And one of the things I think that's really interesting when you start to look at why students are coming to the mental health center, anxiety is actually, anxiety and stress-related issues are the main reason now, not depression, not some of these other things we might think about. So anxiety and stress, these are things that we as instructors in the classroom can really think about. How can I get this content across in a way that's not going to add to that stress level and that anxiety level? And again, going back to talking to students, when you ask students about anxiety and stress, they're very honest. They're like, we get that we're at the University of Texas. We get that we're in the electrical and computer engineering program, and we're going to be under stress. That's acceptable. That's reasonable. But does it have to be at a level mm-hmm. that makes people so miserable and so unable to sleep and so at these levels? So sharing with, like, trying to get faculty to think from the perspective of students, right? Which I think is one of the things that Nina and a lot of the people on this project who volunteered to sort of pilot this project do really well, is they really do try to think about, put themselves in students' shoes and really think from the perspective of students, that coming to their specific class and performing in their specific course is just one small thing that these students are doing. Many of these students have jobs. Some of them have families, including their own children. So really trying to think about the student as a whole person, and where does this course fit into their lives? And then how can I make it so that they're as successful as possible, reaching their potential, and also happy, like Nina said. I don't think that these are impossible things to do. There's also an interesting Gallup poll that came out over the last year that talks about the importance of having at least one professor who cares about you, that alumni talked about, alumni who felt engaged in their work and felt engaged in their life. Many of them talked about the importance of having one faculty, not every faculty member, yeah. but having one faculty member who really demonstrated that they cared about them, that they acted as a mentor to them, that they helped them focus on their life goals and achieving those goals. And so I think the more that we can kind of spread this out and get as many faculty kind of thinking about this, like, how can you be that professor for these students, right? How can you be the one that shows that you care in very small ways and very not these, you know, faculty will talk to me about, you know, I have to do this or I have to do that to my classroom. No, like, these are just changing little things about the way you interact with students, the way you interact, draw the relationships between the students and the content and how you get that across to them. So that's another indicator. Another one, you know, this is new to the college level, and not a lot of people are doing this at the college level, but social emotional learning is something that has been a focus in pre-K through 12 education for the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just reading this week that there's in Virginia, some high school students went to the legislature and got them to pass a law where every high school in Virginia now has to teach mental health in 9th and 10th grade. So it's coming up. It's just that it takes maybe a little bit more time to get to the college level than to the elementary, middle, high school levels. So students, it's actually a really good thing. We have students now who are coming who are much more aware of mental health, of the importance of well-being. And I think that a lot of times, you know, they're just supposed to take our class and I struggled through it this way and everybody else has struggled through it. It's like trial by fire. And these students are saying it doesn't have to be that way. I don't think it ever had to be that way. We just sort of accepted that. And now we have these students who are very well-versed, who are very knowledgeable about these things saying, we don't accept that. Like we should be focusing on the whole person and thinking about students as human beings versus just people who need to get this content done in the next 4 years and get out.
Yeah. Thea, when you mentioned, you know, that this is something that we haven't been so cognizant of in higher level education, whereas K through 12, yes, teachers are trained and, you know, whereas college professors, I mean, we are not necessarily trained in teaching. And I think that is part of it. And we kind of expect students to be, you know, or at least, yeah, so far that has been the case, that we kind of expect students in the college classroom to be adults. But I think it's a little more than that. And, you know, as professors, we do have, there is a power relationship and students sense it and they look up to us. So in that sense, yes, we're all adults in the classroom, but faculty are, we have a certain power that students don't. And as a result, there is a feeling of inadequacy that could come with it. And I think that is what holds many students back is, okay, you know, I'm not going to ask for help because I don't want to appear stupid in front of my peers, in front of the professor. So regardless of whether the professor is their favorite, they still look up to us and they don't want to disappoint us and they don't want to, you know, appear stupid. And so that it's a downward spiral. Yeah. And so once they come into our classroom with these feelings and these kind of expectations that they put on themselves, it can, you know, quickly spiral downward. So I think as an instructor, you know, it is our responsibility, in addition to delivering the content and delivering the content in a clear way and teach very well. There is another kind of component, I think, that is important in teaching. It's the connection that you have with students. So like Thea was saying, you know, it's not the big things. It's actually the small things. So if a student, you know, tells me, in just maybe a casual conversation, that he or she is looking to find an internship in the summer, then the next conversation I have with the student, I will actually ask the student, oh, you know, did you actually, you know, how have you been progressing on that front? And I think it's these little things that really help with making students feel like they are noticed by us, that they are acknowledged, that their struggles are important.
Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead a couple of questions, but then jump back.
Okay.
Because Thea gave me an opening for this. So this mindset that exists in academia, that misery builds character in a way, or I guess more to the point, that there's an argument to be made that college is supposed to be tough and challenging, that some can cut it and some can't, and that's part of what we're trying to determine about people, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the pedagogical argument for being so concerned about the emotional well-being of students?
Yeah.
And like you said, Thea, I mean, people who've been through it, they have a certain pride about it.
Right.
And about their scars.
Even. Right.
I think there's that people have this impression that if you are concerned about the emotional well-being of students, then it means that you are a kind of a pushover, that you would not be as, you know, as tough an instructor or not be as, and I think that the two things are mutually exclusive. So you can challenge the students, and students in fact want that. They want to be, I mean, they're paying for this. They want to be learning a lot and they want to be challenged. But at the same time, they, you know, they also want to be treated like human beings. And yes, it is true that when faculty were students themselves, maybe the education system and higher level education was that way, or maybe that's our memory of it, or maybe it's because we were the high achieving students in the first place when we were in college, and we have a certain memory of it, and we, you know, we kind of think that, yeah, that is the way it should be. But we also know that it does not work for everyone. And, you know, but we are not kind of cognizant, we are not kind of aware of the fact that really this type of teaching is not an inclusive way of teaching. And I think that is where, you know, this mindset comes in, is that, you know, a student can be at one place on one given day, but can be in a different place in a different, on a different day, in a different week in the semester. Mm-hmm. And that progress is what we need to applaud.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so good. So I have lots of thoughts about this. One of the things I think is interesting, that I always think about with this, like, you know, trial by fire, I always think about college and why is it the one place educationally that we think the misery has to happen? Because we don't, like, in pre-K through 12, we actually try to create these sort of communities. We talk about, you know, communities in classrooms, and we really try to, we talk about relationship building with students and how important, I mean, you can look at the research on relationship building and how that's one of the number one factors for student success, is that the student has a relationship with a faculty person in, and when I talk about pre-K through 12, yeah, in pre-kindergarten, we have social emotional objectives that we teach, like somewhere around 30 of them in the Texas, right, pre-K guidelines. We teach these things. So we know social emotional is so important. And it's like, well, and then they get hit 18 and now they've got all figured out. Like, yeah, we don't have to worry about social, yeah, emotional stuff anymore. And I don't, and then what's interesting to me, and then we go to graduate school. We both get in graduate school, is wonderful. I tell people graduate school is like being in pre-K again.
Yeah.
It's like all of a sudden you have these relationships with the faculty members. They might not be great with every faculty member, but you always have one or two or three faculty who you get to know really well and who you do research with. You're allowed to kind of branch out and kind of figure out what you want to do with your life. And you, yeah, can do research in this area or that area, and you get people to kind of help you. And all of a sudden you're like, it's like you've come full circle. But the last little part before you get to graduate school is like the worst.
Yeah.
Right? College. And you just have to suffer through it, right? And
such a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, I always, yeah, it's interesting to me that we think college has to be this,
yeah,
because it has to be rigorous, or because we have this standard, and like, if we just have to, everybody has to meet this standard, and we don't really, I mean, I don't understand. Like, it really, yeah, doesn't make logical sense to me, where this is actually probably one of the most important places to have the social emotional stuff, because you have so many students who are on their own for the first time, right? They've moved out of their houses. Yes. They're becoming young adults. So,
yeah,
so this is the thing too, I think about, like, many, you know, 100 years ago, we really didn't think of adolescence as a period in life. Adolescence only fairly recently has been something that we study and we think about as a time period. The same thing's happening now with young adulthood, right? That's becoming a time period in life that we study. There's actually journals devoted to studying young adults. So this 18 to 25 year old time period. And so instead of thinking about, now they're adult, they're fine, we don't have to worry about them, they should be able to do this stuff on their own, they're having to figure out about how to pay bills, how to do their own laundry.
Well, in our world, we talk about transition age youth. But
yeah,
it's more like, yeah, ages like 14 through 21, but it's kind of the same thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. So this transition, and I mean, this transition is huge. And as Nina's talked about, how diverse the students are. So you have students with many, many different needs based on their backgrounds, based on their experience. And so thinking that you're just going to be able to kind of push them through this, yeah, machine of content, and just cram as much content as you can into students and hope that they come out the other side,
yeah,
better for it. It really doesn't make a lot of sense, yeah, to me. It's just breaking that barrier down,
yeah,
between students and faculty.
Yeah.
And decreasing maybe a little bit of that power relationship,
yeah,
right? So it's not that the professor is way up here and the students are way down here. That's why I talk about like trying to decrease that power differential. It's still going to be there.
Yeah.
The professor's, the instructor's always going to have more power in the classroom than the students. But if we can decrease it a little bit and let students see that, you know.
Yeah, so there's less of a tension. And I think that because students sense it more than we do. And we, it's not like we want to generate tension in the class so that we are kind of, you know, we want them to sense this power every second of every lecture, not at all.
Yeah.
In fact, it's not intentional at all in any way. But, you know, they know that we are the ones who are giving the grades and we're the ones who are grading exams. And of course, it's going to happen.
Right. So I was not planning on mentioning this, but I can't help it now, just listening to the two of you. During my last semester as a full-time undergraduate student, so this would be in 2000, I decided that I was to finish that semester. So I loaded up on 19 hours of classes. That's, I think, 6 courses plus a lab for one of them. Didn't fully appreciate, as it turned out, just what a house of cards that I had created. Mm-hmm. And once things started to veer off course, it didn't take a whole lot for me to go into a complete tailspin that I just wasn't able to pull myself out of. And then I sort of crossed a threshold where I just said, fuck it, it's too late. I'll absorb the F's, I'll absorb the I's, and then try to, to pick up the pieces afterward.
Yeah.
The picking up of those pieces turned into an 8-year struggle.
Okay.
Wow.
To finally complete my BA.
Okay.
Which I didn't do until 2008.
Okay.
And I've had plenty of time since then to wonder what might have helped. Because I didn't have a plan B and a plan C once things were first less than perfect, and then a whole lot less than perfect, and then an unfolding catastrophe. One thing that I'm a little bit incited by is how it is that when it comes to students, it seems that the best of what we know about achieving success is sort of packaged and sold as success secrets that only a lucky few possess. So whether that's how to study, how to write a good essay, you would think that the most important things that students would know, including how not to spiral in the way that I did, would just kind of be readily available to them, And I don't know that I have one coherent point to make, but that's just what this conversation kind of sort of triggers in me. First, some painful memories, but then at the same time, for example, if researchers have known for decades what makes for effective study techniques, why wouldn't that be required learning for freshman students? Yeah. Why is it a secret that you, or a life hack that you find out about on the internet? What I mean?
Is it okay?
Yeah, of course.
So I think, there is this notion that college students, say in UT, they get admitted based on their high school GPAs and their SAT scores. And so instructors very often kind of assume that, you're in this classroom, you're in this major, and clearly, you have shown that you are a good student. That you, you've crossed certain hurdles in middle and high school, and with that comes the study habits, and with that comes a certain kind of self-discipline. So in college, there is and on top of that, it's there is this notion that college is it's not mandatory, and so if you're here, it's because you have shown that you have been a successful student and that you want to be here. So between those two things, there is this kind of this belief that you have to figure it out. And I think that is where we fail as instructors, is kind of letting students know that, no, you know, it is as much my responsibility as an instructor to help you kind of succeed. And I think part of it is letting students know early on that seeking help is not a sign of weakness at all. In fact, it's a sign of strength, because it shows that you dare to care. You know, there is a certain strength that comes with caring about that showing that you care about this, that showing that that this matters to you, that showing that you are not, meeting your own expectations, showing that you are not understanding something in class, or that you are falling behind, or, whatever it is. And I think if students kind of know that early on, it'll mean that they're, and early on meaning as freshmen, then it is, it's likely that they kind of, they continue on in their curriculum on like a good solid footing. Because I think experiencing quote unquote failure early on is what results in this kind of spiraling down.
Right.
And yeah. So yeah. And I think that part of, you know, what we can do in the classroom, so this goes back to what I was saying earlier about large class sizes and how, you know, how does an instructor in a large undergraduate classroom, I mean, how do you manage that? And I think part of having kind of a sense of well-being in the classroom also comes through socializing with peers. So I think students, a big part of them not seeking help or not wanting to seek help is that they don't want to be appearing stupid in front of their peers. So if you do have kind of group activities in the classroom, if the student does not feel like he or she is noticed or known by the instructor, if he or she feels that he's noticed by peers, and that is great too.
Yeah.
And I think that also goes along with kind of, you know, this whole sense of well-being in the learning environment is having your peers also support you.
Yeah.
So if you do that kind of regularly all through the semester, then peers can also notice that, okay, that this student is actually struggling, and, and that kind of can be elevated, because otherwise, you know, it's hard for an instructor to know exactly where every student is at.
Yeah.
But with the help of other students, you can actually, provide the supportive environment.
So Nina, getting down to the nitty gritty, I mean, maybe if you could give just an idea of how it is that you're implementing the project in your classroom and what you hope that the outcome will be.
Okay. So for me, I strongly, strongly believe in the growth mindset. And I started believing in it, unfortunately, only after post-college. but, you know, it's something that I really encourage in my own family at home. And I have two kids who are kind of the same age as the students that I teach. So for me, a big part is kind of imparting that is, you know, you are at this place now. And I think with freshmen, that is very, very important, with teaching freshman classes, is letting them know that there is nothing like a fixed intelligence. There's nothing like, that I'm not good at, that I'm taking this calculus class and I'm failing in it, so I'm not good at math. And now what do I do? Because they really do believe it. They believe that their scores actually indicate, you know, their level of understanding. Okay. And they do believe in performance goals. They don't believe in mastery goals. So I think a big part of the growth mindset, it's tied very closely to mastery goals. And but the education system is centered around performance goals. So it doesn't quite kind of, they don't know what to make of that. I mean, these are 18, 19 year olds who also look up to us, who kind of are immersed in this educational system. And what do they do? So I think a big part of what I do in the classroom is kind of inviting questions from students. So something that I learned from Thea is doing this thumbs up, thumbs sideways, thumbs down. Mm-hmm. And so I do poll my students regularly through every lecture to kind of find out where they're at. And that way they kind of, they know that it is okay to ask any question. And if I don't have, you know, if I'm getting questions from the same students over and over again, then I make it a point to kind of look at a section of the classroom that is not asking questions and that kind of, and in a very kind of, they know that I'm a fairly approachable faculty member. I'm a fairly approachable instructor.
Approachable, not fairly.
I'm an approachable person. So they know that it takes just the first time to articulate and to verbalize a question, and that once they've crossed that barrier, then they're good to go for the rest of the semester. They can keep asking questions, because for a student, it's very, very scary to hear their own voice in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Just hearing their own voice is like, they're just not used to it. So that's a big part of it, is the growth mindset, mastery goals. And then, like Thea was saying, metacognitive kind of behaviors. The metacognitive culture in the classroom. So thinking about, you know, where you're at. I mean, if you're asking a question, it requires students to kind of really check in with themselves, you know, having that kind of self-awareness that, you know, this is something that I do not know. So that forces them to think about their thinking. And so that is kind of having an active learning environment rather than a passive learning environment.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So can I add on to that? Because I've actually observed Nina teach several times.
Yeah.
I've watched her teach her 306 class, mm-hmm. which is an introductory class to computing.
To computing,
right? Yeah. And then I've also watched her teach this one-hour course that she created to teach students about things like what she was talking about, like growth mindset, mastery versus performance. She's also talked with students about like the anxiety and these kinds of things, and helping them talk about like strategies, time management strategies. I've heard her talk about with the students in that one-hour class. But in the 306 class, I want to highlight, because she talked about a few things, and this is one of the things that I find on this project, because my background is instruction and learning. My doctorate is in educational psychology. I have been involved in education for, you know, almost 25 years, teaching and learning in different capacities as a teacher, as an administrator in a district. And so my big thing is looking at instruction and examining instruction and pulling out what's good about instruction and what is something that you could tweak or change a little bit to make instruction stronger. And so, as Nina said earlier, these folks who I'm working with are engineers, they're pharmacists, they're historians. They're not trained in teaching, right? They're basically put in classrooms to teach, and so they can do their research or these things, but they don't have the background in educational psychology that I have. So they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be experts in their area.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't always know all the things that they're doing well. And so one of the things that I've done on this project after I go in and observe is a lot of times after I observe, if I can, I try to send them an email to highlight the things that are effective in their instruction, so they start to realize that's an effective thing and why it's effective and why they should keep doing it. And that's what a lot of the faculty have told me that they have appreciated about this project, is that they knew they kind of were going with their gut, that this was something good to do. They just really weren't sure why they were doing it or why it was effective. And so for me to just kind of highlight and show them those things. So in Nina's class, for example, one of the things that she does really, really effectively, one of the things that she does do is allow for questions. That's a consistent thing across these faculty. Mm-hmm. Faculty who students nominate as being good with well-being are good with student questions. They encourage student questions, and they don't just encourage them by saying, "Are there any questions?" They actually legitimately have an attitude of, "I want you to ask questions because that's going to tell me where you are. And it's okay if you don't understand this. I need to know that so that I can go back and reteach it or tweak it somehow so that I can help you to understand it." That's one thing. But one of the other things that she does that's really effective that a lot of teachers aren't really trained or know how to do is she does what we call in instruction an I do, we do, you do. So the I do is where you model something first. So you model and kind of model, especially in engineering, these things like modeling the kind of thinking that has to go on to be able to solve these problems or write these programs. So she does a lot of modeling, but she does a lot of we do, where she was talking about the group work. So she has the students work in groups together to do things. That's the we, right? And then she's also there to support and scaffold. So she walks around and she is teaching in a classroom that has about 80 students. It's in an auditorium style classroom that is not very conducive to doing this kind of instruction, but she makes it work. And that's one of the things a lot of faculty, well, I'm in this auditorium, I can't really do this. Mm-hmm. Well, you can, it's just not going to be as easy to do. And it's you know, it's going to be harder for you to get around and listen to the students. But what she does too, is she pulls the students back and forth back into her. She pulls them back together, says, okay, I heard you guys talking about this. Let's work through this program together. They start working on it together. Then she allows them to make mistakes. And then she'll say, there's a mistake in this program right here. I need you to work with your group. I need you to identify where the mistake is, because we as a group have made a mistake here. And then that's another research-based method for teaching, is providing worked examples and worked non-examples. So where there are mistakes, and allowing students to see that it's okay to make a mistake, but we've got to be able to identify it. So let's do that as a group together so that we're successful with this. And she does that so that when they go and they do their lab or they do their homework on their own, which is the you do, you go do this by yourself now, they can be more successful.
And it's a fun part of teaching, frankly. It's fun.
Well, and
to
you
kind of walk around. I'm not just standing in the front of the classroom where the only voice heard is mine.
Yeah.
You're actually connecting, and these are youth.
I read enough of the Chronicle of Higher Education, in some of the more overwrought essays from academics, you sometimes wonder if they actually like dealing with students.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's true. That's actually one of the things. We're writing this guidebook right now, and we're kind of breaking into parts these different things. One's effective learning environment. So doing some of these things I've talked about that Nina does. One of them is just the thinking about the student as a whole, like we've talked about already. And that's one thing, is like, just be happy.
Yeah.
Be happy that you're in the class. Teaching is actually fun.
Yes.
I mean, teaching, it can be fun.
It can be fun. Yes.
If you have the attitude that it's going to be fun. Yeah. But it does, honestly, like, to make it fun, it's the same thing for me. The standing up and talking part isn't the fun part. The fun part is when I release control over to the students and I get to watch them learn, and I get to have the discussions and I hear the questions, and then we can really go deep with learning versus me standing up and giving a bunch of information. That's okay initially. Like, you have to do that because you have to have a certain level of knowledge to start with. But at some point, you kind of have to step back and see what students are going to do with it and be there when they're doing it. Right. And not just on exam, because that what's happened on exam is students are like, OK, that's the end. The exam is the end of it. They don't even. Right. And that's another thing we can change, too, if we want, like Brian Evans does, is he takes the exams and uses them as a learning tool. Yeah. So it's not just that's the end all be all. It's like, let's take this exam and let's break it down and let's look and see. So because you have to know this stuff for the next set of learning. Right. So some of those things that I'm talking about now are kind of bigger things, right? Like sort of bigger shifts that would take, that you don't have to do. You can just do some of the little things like Nina's talked about. But there are bigger shifts that we could make in our classrooms, like related to grading practices and the way that exams are a huge thing that come up with students, of course, all the time about.
Okay.
So
as I mentioned in my intro, well-being and learning environments is just one part of a larger grant initiative. If you would like to know more about what we're doing in mental health and education, check out episode 42, Mental Health in Schools, on SoundCloud or iTunes. Or you can find our blog post about it on the Foundation website, which contains links to it. Thea, Nina, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.